It's time to meet up and catch up at the Weekend Water Cooler. Now, here's your host, Gene Bolduc.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Weekend Water Cooler. We're talking some more with our good friend and generous partner over here at WCHL, Dr. Aaron Keck. The doctor's in.
Hello.
Aaron, thank you for summarizing the year with me. I always feel better at the end of the year because we can do this review, and it reminds me that interesting and important things happen. And by the way, that some of them were good.
Yes.
We always try to include the fact that, you know, some of these things are actually good things.
Are we going to cover any good things
no.
in this hour? Okay, good. Yeah, I'm looking down the list here.
No, that's not
like
that.
You're setting
that's
us up that. To do something that we have no intention of doing.
Well, I'm going to take something that's negative and say it's a
okay,
positive.
Good.
So I think you'll be surprised and impressed.
No,
by
I see where your pen is hovering over,
yeah,
and I see where you're
one.
Going
yeah,
with that.
It's
yeah,
it's pretty unlikely that I'll pull it off. But.
Yeah.
Well, let's start with the most unlikely of explicable things, which is net neutrality. Net neutrality ended in 2018. Does anybody even remember that, that it existed?
For now, right. Net neutrality has come and gone and come and gone again.
Yes, so but we hope that it's kind of the zombie of such things, that maybe it'll just be back and walking among us.
That debate is not over. So net neutrality, how are we going to explain this? Internet service providers speeding up or slowing down service to various websites or having the ability to do that and then charging the websites or passing the cost along to the people who access the service.
Charging
so that
more
they
money for more speed.
Direct people to the websites that cooperate with them, and they have the power to do that, basically.
Right. And you know, to be fair, there is an issue of providing – you know, what we would call, I guess, the pipe, you know, the signal of all that service and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And that, you know, people make varying levels of use of those services. And if you look at it from the flip side perspective, if you're a fairly low level user of those services and you don't need to be able to run your television and your video editing business and all of these things that just gobble up capacity in the system. If you basically want to check your email a couple of times a day,
you won't even notice.
And you would, you know, your presence on there is just this tiny amount of data that's being used. You could look at it from the perspective that you'd like to be able to discount for that, you know, user and hold down the cost of internet access for that user.
But
we all know
means,
it's not really for that.
Right. That also means that certain websites, certain providers are going to promote certain websites that go along, demote certain other websites that go along. Net neutrality was the rule that says if you're an internet service provider, you can't do that. You have to provide the same speed for every service. And I'm going to argue that net neutrality is one of the most important stories, kind of under the radar of 2018, because so much dominated the headlines. Net neutrality didn't really, but I'm going to argue that it's one of the top stories of 2018 because of how much it galvanizes a surprising percentage of Americans, particularly, and we're going to talk about the role of younger people, younger voters, students, high school students, college students, in getting involved in politics and activism and voting. Net neutrality is one of the issues
it's really important
that gets younger people on board because they understand how the internet works, which means they understand how important net neutrality is and how much things can change if you lose it.
And they can visualize the potential of it in areas that we haven't yet imagined and things, you know, things of gaming and streaming and things that that older users have limited caring or use for, but also they've grown up in an era of things coming into being that they didn't imagine that nobody knew about 5 years ago. They expect that to happen now all the time.
Oh, yeah.
They're right to expect
correctly,
that.
Correctly, yeah.
Yes, they're
that's
exactly
how it's
right
be.
To expect it. So so that's just a kind of consumer demand that we've not really seen before But we're going to see now, and how that manifests itself politically is going to be really, really interesting.
Yes.
And I agree with you. I think net neutrality is going to be right in the core of that.
And I think
for
people,
building infrastructure and capacity.
And I think younger people especially very much understand another important truth, which is becoming more and more evident as we get further and further into the online age, which is just how much control tech companies, big corporations have over our ability to speak, our ability to express ourselves,
right,
and our ability to access information.
That's information that's not corrupted.
Yeah. There was a Supreme
Court
case.
By any number of ways, yes.
There was a Supreme Court case earlier this year, comes out of North Carolina, in which the Supreme Court struck down a law, state law, banning sex offenders from using social media like Facebook and Twitter. And the reason they did that, and they were 100% right to do it, this was a correct decision by the Supreme Court, the reason they did that was that social media has become so ubiquitous, so dominant,
right,
that if you are prevented from using social media, that prevents you from speaking or expressing yourself. So you have to be Alex Jones and
please
speak,
don't be.
Speak in a way that that throttles other people's free speech in order for it to be justified that you get banned from Twitter. If you're getting banned from Twitter just because Twitter decides or because the state decides that you shouldn't have access, that's a First Amendment violation.
Right.
And what that suggests is the only way that we can be heard anymore is by going on Twitter and by going on Facebook. The only way that we get information anymore is by going on Google or going on Wikipedia. Those are all privately owned companies, which means that our public square is now a private square that these companies can limit our access to however they choose. That's a serious thing. Younger voters get that,
yeah,
and
they are speaking
out and they are voting based on
their
those
worry
issues. About that.
So these would be really good issues to put onto ballots in 2020. They will bring young voters out. And of course, we haven't really discussed this as an issue like that, but you know, legalizing marijuana is another one that is going to bring the youth into the voting booth.
And there are a lot of issues that are going to bring the youth in the voting booth. Net neutrality, access to online information, legalizing marijuana, sure, guns and gun control, health care, the high cost of higher education.
Right.
And those are just the issues that I'm thinking of off the top of my head.
That just come to you right away. Exactly.
But net neutrality is a big one that I think flew under the radar a little bit more than it should have in 2018.
Yeah, but I totally agree with you. I don't think it's going away, no how. And we do have – we have this whole different world of who student activists are in our society. – And incredibly, you know, I had to look this up because I wasn't sure if the Parkland shooting occurred in 2018. It feels like it's a long time ago.
It was a long time ago.
It was February.
It was
Valentine's Day in 2018, and the mobilization of these students from Parkland. How that's translated into political action is, I think, one of the most impressive things I've seen politically, and I don't think it's anywhere near reached its peak at all.
No. And I think another thing that kind of flew under the radar in 2018, because we haven't seen it translate into policy yet. We haven't seen action on the federal level. We haven't seen much action on state levels in terms of increased gun control and gun regulation. We haven't seen the parameters of the debate really changing in terms of what gets passed and what doesn't. But the students from Parkland dominated the discussion in a way that I don't think any group of gun control
advocates had
before. And the thing that flew under the radar, donations to the NRA went way down in 2018. Membership in the NRA went down in 2018. I think the NRA has peaked.
Yes.
And I think it might be a while several years maybe before we really start to see the effect of that in policy. But I think the tipping point did happen in February of 2018.
Yeah, looking back,
or,
you can
or
see
more
that.
To the point, March and April of 2018,
right.
When the Parkland students were still out there, still talking to
doing
people.
Doing their march, their national march,
doing
which
the
was
march,
well-funded, well-organized.
Involved. And
brilliant, brilliant.
Keeping the issue and their personal experience in the public eye.
Yeah.
I think that was a tipping point in a way that we don't realize yet.
I tell you, if you were Joe Manchin, you know, and guys like him who are trying to walk this mm-hmm. this scary middle place, I think that the NRA supported members of Congress should be very, very nervous about their future and. In the context of the issue, because
a lot of them lost their seats already.
Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah. Good luck in your new careers, folks.
Yeah.
So we're gonna take a quick break and step aside. We're talking to Aaron Keck about the end of the year, and we know it. Wrapping up the national issues that we've looked at this year, and some of the individual people who have had the biggest impact on the news, more on the. State and national level, I guess, than our previous program. This is so much fun. I love doing this. I wish we could end the year every month. That sounds wrong. We're going to be back to talk a little more with Aaron. You're listening to The Weekend Water Cooler on 97.9 The Hill. Don't go away. We'll be right back. And we're back with Aaron Keck talking with It's the End of the Year and We Know It. Let's get a couple of things out of the way. Interesting books that were published this year, Fire and Fury, mm-hmm. which everybody thought was just the biggest thing, flew off the shelves, as did Bob Woodward's book, Fear, flew off the shelves. But the bestseller of the year is Michelle Obama's book, which
yep.
has been out about a week and a half.
I haven't read any of those three. How are they?
I'm reading Fear right
okay.
now. The other one I didn't buy because it seemed a little too gossipy, for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I figured, you know, I would get a lot of it online. It would be clickbait left, right, and sideways, which
yes.
it kind of has turned out to be. But yeah, Woodward's book, Woodward's book will put its title into you because it's very revealing on the stunning incompetence that exists in the president and himself and in the administration generally.
The incompetence to me is reassuring because what the president is calling for is very often the sort of thing that I would not want to see in a million years. So if he does a bad job implementing it, so much the
right.
better as far
so
as I'm concerned.
So it's like, well, he wouldn't know how to do that even if he really, really wanted to, and he's probably only saying he wants to because he thinks it'll get him attention for the next day or two, whatever.
And correctly, by the way, that's yeah. the one thing he is good at, which is understanding how to get attention.
I'll give you my favorite example of the kind of thing I'm talking about is that it's described in the book that they talk to him about, Mr. Trump, during the campaign,
mm-hmm.
It turns out that you know, you don't vote very much. You know, you didn't vote in primaries. He said, yes, I did. I always vote in the primaries. They said, no, you didn't. And he says, I totally didn't. They say, so they go back and forth with him.
Mm-hmm.
And they finally say to him, look, Mr. Trump, we can see when you have voted. This is public record. And he says, it's supposed to be a secret ballot. And they said, no, we don't see who you voted for. We can see that you, and they show him, you know, sheets of paper with words on them that say, you know, you voted on this day and that day, you know, across the years. And then he almost never voted in a primary as an adult,
mm-hmm.
and didn't always vote at all. And that, you know, he's outraged to find out that this is public information.
Yeah.
How in the world are you running for president and you don't know that? That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
That's not the most, you know, that's not the throw rate of a ballistic missile. I mean, that's, holy cow, how do you not know that? And then, of course, the important element there is that when they tell him this, he argues with them.
Yes,
lying,
course.
Not knowing anything.
Yeah.
Saying, of course I did. That's ridiculous. Of course I did. Well, yeah, okay. Yeah, it is ridiculous. He's right about that. So speaking of voting, the state of Florida, in a stunning move, has empowered 1.5 million felons with restoring their voting rights. This is absolutely fascinating. This was a ballot initiative in a state that, you know, went ahead to elect the wrong governor, by the accounts of most people on our side of these things. And yet this was pretty broadly cross party lines and won overwhelmingly.
Reinstating the right of felons to vote struck me as the sort of thing that would have been a hard sell, but apparently not. So good for Florida. Not the first state. This has happened, and I mean this is a growing trend across the country of states that are starting to recognize that.
Right.
Maybe this was a bad idea to have done in the first place, and restoring the voting rights for people who have been in the system for a while and understand how it works and might have a bit of a stake in the outcome of elections. Go figure.
Yeah.
So, you know, positive development. But yeah, in a year when Florida voters went Republican in most of the high-profile state-level races, albeit by narrow margins, the fact that they overwhelmingly passed this was a surprise. But I think it's good, and I think you and I are in agreement on this, that could have a really, really big impact on
enormous.
How Florida votes in 2020 and beyond, because Florida is the swingiest state.
Yeah, but this is very likely to benefit a Democrat running for
probably,
president.
Probably, yeah. There were a lot of really significant referendums and initiatives that passed across the country. I think in North Carolina, we were a little bit people on the left were a little bit disappointed by the outcome on voter ID and the state tax cap, the income tax cap. Did end up getting two of those six state constitutional amendments rejected. So wins for Democrats there. But across the country, there were a lot of referendums that passed that were really significant. The one in Florida there, you've got in Michigan, there was – and in a couple of other states, there were significant electoral reforms to
right.
eliminate gerrymandering.
Right.
Enable people to register to vote more easily, automatic voter registration in some states, moving over to legalized marijuana in states
right.
like Michigan, and that wasn't the only one. There were a lot.
I think some went to recreational
yes.
authorization for not just medical.
Regardless of your stance on the legalization of marijuana, I can tell you from the Michigan experience that just stopping at medicinal marijuana is not actually a solution. Either go all the way
or
not.
Don't do it. And, you know, look, you got to follow the money, people. Come on. It's a big cash crop. And
it is.
And North Carolina would benefit enormously from legalizing marijuana, which is sold, you know, off the radar in the state and everybody knows it.
So that was big, the blue wave, obviously, for the House of Representatives, if not the Senate. And just for this one purpose, how lucky is it for Democrats that Hillary Clinton did not win in 2016?
You know, I'm telling you, that's going to end up as a historical matter. That's going to end up saving the Republic and saving the Democratic Party in particular.
Maybe. I don't know if Trump winning saves the Republic, but I think
– I think it does.
I think it might be a good thing long term for the Democratic Party. If only because the president's party usually loses in the midterm election. So 2018 was really historically no exception. It was more of a win for the opposition party than you usually see, but not even by much. Had Hillary Clinton been the president in 2018, Republicans would probably have at least a 15 and maybe a 20 vote edge in the Senate.
Right. And
it might be 60-40 at this point.
I think that's exactly right. And I think that her presidency would have been crippled by constant investigation, harassment, and all the things that Trump is trying to complain that
right.
is being done to him. You're just bothering me because you lost. there would have been, you know, Benghazi on steroids just every day, all the time. She would have been she would find it extremely difficult, yeah, if not impossible, to govern.
Yeah.
And I just don't think you can overstate how willing the Republican Party would have been 100%. To just make that misery for
which
her.
Which is sad, because just in general, like Hillary Clinton over her career, if you leave her alone to do her job, she's great.
She
as
does a
senator
great job.
From New York,
right,
a secretary of state, mm-hmm, probably would have been the same thing as president, but that would not have been the case.
And would have been a lot closer to being center right than people would probably like
also
to realize.
True.
Not,
yeah,
not a crazy liberal, way, way out there on the fringe in,
yeah,
terms of where she is politically on the spectrum.
I still want to build a time machine just so I can go back to 1993 and tell everyone that in 20 years, Hillary Clinton will have trouble getting elected president because a lot of people think she's too conservative.
Well, you would,
and then I would destroy the time machine.
You would just blow up the space-time continuum entirely, and then we'd all be on Mars waiting for the rover to come and get us.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break and step aside for just a moment. We're talking to Aaron Keck about it's the end of the year, and we know it, and we're reviewing all these wonderful stories and perspectives that I can't believe all poured themselves into just 2018. It feels like it's been 3 years instead of just one. But anyway, you're listening to us, thank goodness, on 97.9 The Hill. Please don't go away. So we're back talking with Aaron Keck, and in this segment, it's going to feel a little bit like Debbie Downer, but it's important to look at these things. Let's talk about important passings that we had this year. I'm gonna start with pointing out that I think Aretha Franklin's funeral may still be going on. That was quite a demonstration, that funeral,
mm-hmm,
and the segment of time between the time that she died and the time of the funeral was 7 or 8 days at least,
remember.
I think. And then the funeral, I remember that the day of the funeral, I think, was on a Saturday. And by that point, her remains had been moved to several different places. She had had a wardrobe change a couple of times and then arrived at the final destination. This was to allow the people in the Detroit area to come and pay their respects and at various different locations. And then on the day of the funeral, I remember it specifically because I went down to the beach that day. And, you know, we left Chapel Hill. We drove for 3.5 hours. We got to the beach. And the funeral was maybe almost halfway,
yes,
over. It was quite a day. And it was almost everybody's sorry to have seen Aretha Franklin leave us, but what a send off! I mean, what a send off! Somebody observed this morning that or yesterday that the feel good stories of this year are funerals.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
There's something quite inside out about that.
We just got done with George Bush Sr.'s funeral,
right,
which was a coming together moment for the country.
It was. It was an impressive display of political power. Actually, I thought in that Bush 41 basically in his funeral plan commanded,
yes,
that the sitting president attend.
Yes.
Which meant that there was, at the state funeral, the private funeral that's going on in Texas, he was not invited to that, I believe,
only,
and he wouldn't,
right,
go anyway.
Right.
Well, it was family of 1,200
friends.
People,
yeah,
right? And he wouldn't be going to that anyway. But I thought that was a remarkable display of the Bush family in the person of Bush 41 saying, well, you know what? We think this is how it is. We think that this is the country that we're in and that this is a sitting president and he has the current president attend his funeral. I think it was probably left to the kids about whether or not he'd be invited to speak. And I think that that would have been ridiculous and uncomfortable for everyone beyond what already was.
I think, and I don't know what to make of this, but I think it's worth pointing out just as the general observation that in 2018, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm not thinking of a different one off the top of my head, predominant symbol of bipartisan cooperation in 2018 is George W. Bush and Michelle Obama keeping each other stocked with candy during funerals.
That appears to be the centerpiece of holding together the democracy in its own way.
I'm not sure if
just to show simple friendship between people with disagreements politically can look like. Nobody can seem to remember that, I guess.
I have no commentary on that. I don't know if it's a good thing or if it's a sign that we've all gone off the cliff already. I don't know if it's a sign that we were off the cliff but we're pulling ourselves back up. I just think it's a true thing. That's the symbol of bipartisanship in America.
It is, because what else do we have?
But maybe even if we had other things, that would still be a good symbol of bipartisanship. I don't know.
Yeah, it would be. I mean, the other thing is it's just adorable.
Yeah.
Come on, it's adorable.
It is.
Right? So there was that. The McCain funeral apparently was by design a rebuke of the president. And it went, you know, it went all the way in and the president kicked off the week of observation of a sitting United States senator dying in office. He kicked off the week, lest we forget, with refusing to raise the flag over the White House and reducing it to half staff. You know, that's just. You know, and it took public pressure for that to change within 24 hours, which it did. But, you know, he was forced into that and then said stupid and ridiculous things as usual. But the way that this happened with the Bush funeral, none of that occurred. He was rendered silent for a full day on this type of topic. And the statements that were made were the traditional generous he was a good guy kind of statement. So obviously written by the staff. Give me a break.
John McCain's funeral being a rebuke to Trump is kind of emblematic of what so much popular culture is in 2018. I think about the two most popular documentaries of 2018, which were RBG about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Won't You Be My Neighbor about Mr. Rogers.
Yeah.
Both of which, in very different ways, were presenting figures as heroes by virtue of the fact that they were the opposite
of
Donald
Trump. They
were
so unlike Donald Trump. And, you know, it is a fascinating prism that even when he doesn't say so, that we view events in this context.
I propose a universal nationwide New Year's resolution. Next year we don't do that.
I think that's happening.
As much as John McCain's funeral is a rebuke to Donald Trump and these documentaries and everything else, every time Donald Trump is the center of attention, he wins because that's what he wants.
That's his objective.
This is why he says provocative things on Twitter. This is why he goes in front of the cameras and is a blowhard. He wants attention from everyone and he wants his base to love him. And when we pay attention to him and when we think of the world through that prism, we're letting him win. So I propose in 2019 we don't do that.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
And we can start early. We can start on the Aaron Keck show on Fridays when we discuss this, that we can refuse to do our storytelling through that point of
this
view.
This does mean you don't get to talk about Robert Mueller until after the final report is released.
I hate that idea. Well, and I'll tell you, I think that report's going to be about a whole lot more than DJT.
I'm not convinced it's going to include DJT very much at all. We'll see. But I think it's going to be more about other people than about Trump.
Well, just because of the totality of kind of already is, right?
Right.
So, yeah. So we'll come back and cover all of that when we return with the end of the year. And you know it. You're listening to The Weekend Water Cooler on 97.9 The Hill. This should be good. Stay tuned. And we're back with Aaron Keck in our closing moments, and we're gonna wrap up the whole year. Wow, what do you want to start with in these last two? Two plus, I guess.
So we're counting. We're looking at the very biggest stories of the year 2018, and there's two very obvious ones left that we haven't covered. One of which is the debacle surrounding immigration and the government's response to it.
Right.
And the other one is the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court and the debacle surrounding the way the Senate treated Christine Blasey Ford.
Right.
But
let's
end with that, because I know that's the point at which you want to take the bad and turn it into something good.
Yeah, that's going to be that's my magic trick.
Let's
Watch
start
that.
By talking about immigration, which
you know, immigration, I don't even call it immigration anymore. I just call it kids in cages.
Yes.
That's what it is. Is that our president, through his I don't even know what you want to call that, if it's his thinking, his approach to this problem is...
I think it's called Stephen Miller whispering in his ear.
Stephen Miller whispering, the dope whisperer, is separating parents from kids, is blocking people from seeking asylum. He'd like to block anybody and everybody from seeking asylum. And this is all about... using the attempted entry into this country by brown people, mm-hmm. using that for political support among his base to keep the racism going and to manipulate that situation and the needs of those people in order to keep white people afraid of those people and keep them supporting Trump with the idea that he is their protector. And, you know, I look at this in this way, that the thing about Trump is that he's a con man, and that one of the reasons that con men are successful is that they convince people in a short amount of time that there's something to be afraid of and that, you know, this person's going to fix it for you. And they do the con, but then they move on. Then they usually leave town and are not detected while it's going on, and people find things out in retrospect. I think that's where he's going to hit the buzzsaw this year, this coming year. I think that you can't – what did Lincoln say about you can't fool all the people all the time?
Mm-hmm.
And I think he has been successful in fooling some of the people some of the time. And
specifically, you know, what Lincoln says is that you can fool some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool all of the people all the time.
You can't fool all of them all the time.
I don't think Trump wants to fool all of the people.
He wants to fool just enough of them.
Just enough of them and get everyone else's attention. So
yeah.
So three things. It's very difficult for me having a radio job and having to go on the air for 4 hours every weekday on the Aaron Keck Show, 3 to 7 weekdays on 97.9 The Hill. Tune in. But I don't like speaking unless I can say something that I know is correct that 1,000 other people haven't already said before.
Right.
So when it comes to immigration, a lot of people have expressed the crux of the issue way better than I can. But three things. First of all, we've seen this very same debate repeat itself over and over and over and over and over again in American history. It's always the same parameters. It's very much the same people on every side. So to hope that it's going to go away next year, I think, unfortunately, is might be too hopeful. I think the issue is going to keep recycling in various forms, first thing. The second thing is for people on the right who support Donald Trump in this, who think that he is taking steps to fix the problem, Let's talk about fixing the problem that is driving people to the border in the first place. The problem is the situation in Central America. We're talking about the asylum seekers on the border right now in Mexico. It's the situation in El Salvador and Honduras and Guatemala and Nicaragua. Right. If we want to fix the problem, we go down there and we assist those countries in building the economic infrastructure and addressing the problems that have led to the horrible situation that is leading the people to flee in the first place.
That's right.
But we're not doing that. In fact, we're doing exactly the opposite. Trump is trying to cut off support to those countries.
Right. Because he's putting a ridiculous burden on Mexico.
Because he doesn't want to fix the problem. He wants, if anything, to exacerbate the problem. Because the more people are at the border, the more people he can demonize.
Right.
So that's number two. Number three is for, again, conservatives who support the president because this is law and order, we're dealing with illegal immigration. Let's remind everyone that crossing the border illegally, while illegal, is a misdemeanor.
Right.
So to treat people who commit a misdemeanor as if they're violent, armed, and dangerous felons and break out the riot gear and the tear gas and send the literal military down to the border and authorize them
to use
lethal force.
It's immoral.
Not only is it immoral, it's not law and order. It is the opposite of law and order.
That's
arbitrary and capricious. And if you really want a law and order president, this would not be your president.
Well, and that gives me some hope that it's going to end up in front of judges and that it could be stopped that way.
Yeah.
And to the extent that it's going to be interrupted, it's going to be through that mechanism, we hope.
Unfortunately, I think so.
Right.
At least for the next 2 years.
Curiously, although I think for me the person of the year is probably a person we haven't heard from directly, which is Robert Mueller.
Yeah. We're going to end, though, on the person I think is the person of the year.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah.
So I just say about the Mueller investigation, I think that the story of the Mueller investigation is that it's still going on, that the president fired the attorney general the day after the election, put a crony in his place, and yet this investigation is still going on. They're still dropping – probably going to be dropping indictments in the next couple of weeks and are dropping sentencing memos now. And it's still going on, unabated.
In spite of the fact that Mitch McConnell was apparently willing to eat the nomination of Thomas Farr to that seat in North Carolina's Eastern District.
Yeah.
Which Jeff Flake would have voted for if McConnell had just held a vote to protect Bob Mueller. McConnell didn't do that. Flake voted no. Thomas Farr's nomination goes down for now because 2019 is coming and we're going to have another nominee. But Bob Mueller is still investigating.
And has continuously been reporting to Rod Rosenstein. You know, I think that's part of what Mitch has up his sleeve is that he knows a little more than what we know about it. A little more. So the person of the year, I think we can agree on this, is
Christine Blasey Ford. Yep.
Not since Anita Hill has a single individual galvanized the country's attention on a confirmation hearing, that's for sure.
When we talked about this when it was happening and we do our thing, not a thing segment, is this the thing and is this not a thing? What I said then, and I'll stick to this now, was Christine Blasey Ford's accusation was not a thing insofar as I didn't think it was going to change anyone's mind in the Senate.
Right.
And that turned out to be right. Where it is a thing is that it has led – we'll never know how many women who went through the same thing and men who went through the same thing to have the courage now to speak out because she did.
Right. It's impossible to overstate the impact of that. Absolutely impossible. The other thing it brought out into broad daylight is Kavanaugh's stunning testimony. Wildly out of control emotion and so forth. I've never seen a thing like that. And that was I'm embarrassed for him. And I still think he was drunk at the time. And I wish somebody had asked him if he had had a drink that day, because I think that he displayed exactly every behavior that his accuser described of how he behaves when he has been drinking too much.
Mm-hmm.
And I have almost no doubt in my mind that he was under the influence during that hearing. So I will tell you that my overarching view of the year is that I am convinced now that it's been a great blessing to this country that we elected Donald Trump.
Because?
And the reason is John McCain said about his time in Vietnam that he fell in love with his country when he was denied access to it, when he was a prisoner in another country. And I think Americans generally have had a regrettable lack of appreciation for the value of democracy and the tender nature of how of the institutions that hold this country together and the norms politically that you know keep the car going forward. And I think that we I think that we're not lost on that point anymore. I think that we've recollected ourselves and have seen what we feel is a worst case scenario. And now we've survived 2 years of Donald Trump, and we have two more to go, and we can start to wrap our heads around the fact that it's up to us to fix it. I think that this is very much like McCain's appreciation for being deprived of his freedom, and that we've had a sense of seeing what it's not an exercise of paranoia or wild imagination to imagine being deprived of ours. I think we've got that figured out now.
Well,
so I think it's going to be a good thing, and it's going to be a very important legacy, not the one that he wanted for Mr. Trump, that he may have saved the republic by almost blowing it up. Just in process.
I hope you're right.
I hope I'm right, too. Well, thank you. Thank you for wrapping up the year
and
sharing all your time with us. And everybody go out and make it a great year in 2019. I require this of you. thanks for joining us on the Water Cooler, and we'll see you next weekend.
Follow Gene on Twitter at Gene Bolduc and tweet your comments and questions with the hashtag WCHL.